And welcome to a Thursday evening edition of Strictly Confidential. Tonight is a music night. We have an amazing man brought to us by our director of music talent, Mr. Glenn Rivera. Glenn doesn't know of his title. He was just awarded it. Glenn, that's the title. You are now officially the director of music talent. Welcome aboard. And thank you for bringing so many talented artists to this show. This evening's guest is Manny Parrish. He's more commonly known as Man Parrish. Man is considered to be a pioneer of electronic music in the hip-hop genres, and he, along with artists such as Kraftwerk, Art of Noise, Afrika Bambaataa, helped create and define the sound of hip-hop in the early 80s. He was an underground music scene icon in the 80s and 90s, and is one of the most important and influential figures in American electronic dance music. He is a native New Yorker, and Man Parrish was a member of an extended family unit that converged nightly on Studio 54. His nickname, Man, first appeared in Andy Warhol's Interview magazine. His live shows at Bronx hip-hop clubs were spectacles of light and glitter, and pyrotechnics. The form of early hip-hop music he pioneered dominated the post-disco pre-house music scene in the early 80s and was instrumental in the structure of both house and techno music. The New York Times writes, as a gay man, he defies stereotypes set by current hip-hop culture. His release of Hip Hop Bebop Don't Stop was released in It was 1983, and it is still considered a classic in the genre of electronic music. The album went on to sell over 2 million copies worldwide. He was signed on with Elektra Records and managed by David Bowie's manager. Man Parrish recorded and remixed tracks for Michael Jackson and Boy George and Gloria Gaynor. He served as manager for the Village People and Crystal Water, to name just two. Man continues to record from his Brooklyn studio and is a frequent DJ at New York's eclectic night spots and S&M clubs. His Sunday underground party at the Cock Bar on New York's Lower East Side is notorious, to say the least. I also understand that Man is DJing at the Bad Boy Club, where he is running a system that claims 10,000 watts of power. Wow. He is the main DJ and co-founder for a circuit party called Hustler Ball, which has parties in many cities, and they're worldwide. He also has several adult websites and online businesses that keep him busy as a webmaster. And so, we welcome to the show Mr. Man Parrish. Man, welcome to the show.
How are you?
I'm doing great this evening. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. I'm going, wait, who is he talking about? Is that me?
Yes, sir, I'm afraid.
Thank you for a wonderful intro. I want to say
you're very welcome.
On the show. I do listen to it, and I love it. I think you've got a great show going on. And
thank you.
Hello to all the DJs out there that are keeping dance music alive. And I guess before we get started, I do want to say a thank you to Glenn Rivera, who's been wonderful at playing this together and been, I guess, a little bit of a staple there for you.
Yes, Glenn has very much become indispensable. Indispensable in terms of finding music talent for us. Glenn is doing a wonderful job. I couldn't be happier that Glenn is working with the show in that capacity. It doesn't get any better than Glenn.
He's an angel and needs a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yes, he does. Great guy. Man, I have to ask you, how did this start? Did you come from a musical family? What is the story of the early Manny?
I didn't come from... Well, I had piano lessons when I was a kid. I think I took two of them. The piano teacher hit me over the knuckles with a ruler, and I swore I'd never touch a keyboard again. As I grew up a little later on in life, and that was in the 70s. I'm actually turning 50 in a few days. the big crisis moment. But I grew up with rock and roll bands like, David Bowie, Pink Floyd, all the kind of stuff of my era. And of course, with that came, the whole free love and drugs and sex and rock and roll. So I was attracted to music. I couldn't find music that I really liked. I built myself a small synthesizer, and that day it was a Radio Shack thing that just made a couple of bleeps and blurps and, wound up getting high, smoking a joint and playing my own music. But I was always attracted to esoteric kind of music like John Cage. There was a synthesizer group called Tonto's Expanding Headband back in the 70s and stuff like that. A very early Kraftwerk. I didn't know at the time they were Kraftwerk, but those experimental kind of sound, avant-garde, it would be called ambient music today. So I kind of came, I learned music through experimenting. I can't read or write. I can't, you tell me to play a G7 chord, I'll look at you like you're crazy. But if you say that, I'll go, oh yeah, I know what that is, and I'll be able to, I'm ear trained, not book trained.
I see. Well, apparently, that's actually a gift that you're able to do it that way. So many people are forced to learn it. To some, it just comes natural. You're talking about synthesizers. I understand in the early years, you were good friends with a Roland 808.
Yeah, well, I go back even before the Roland 808. I go back to pre-MIDI, which is Musical Instrument Digital Interface. It's a language that synthesizers talk to each other in computers. And I go back before 808s and before MIDI when we had synthesizers with patch cords. If you ever listen to any of the Tomita albums or the old Wendy Carlos Switched on Bach, she used to have those on the front cover, those panels with knobs and patch cords. I had similar setups like that, and you'd have to, there were no push buttons, you couldn't dial up a string sound, you would push a button and get a string sound, you'd have to actually dial it in and actually create sounds from scratch using oscillators and filters and envelope followers and stuff like that. The 808 came a little bit later. I remember being in a cab, and I lived in Manhattan at the time, and the cab driver had a progressive rock and roll station on, and they played a Kraftwerk track, Autobahn. And we got to in front of my house, and this was the first time it was played on the radio, I guess, in New York, one of the few first times. And we both sat there. He shut the meter off, and I had said, what is it, a 10-minute track or something like that? And we just sat there totally stunned, because back in the day, you didn't hear anything like that on the radio. It was either rock and roll or funk or country, maybe some dance music starting to happen, but certainly not on the radio. So I became fascinated by this, what's this new sound? How did they do that? How did they make it? Went out to a couple of music stores, that group Kraftwerk, and they said, oh, they use these drum machines. So before the 808 classic drum machine, club sound drum machine came out, there were some early ones like CompuRhythm and Boss Rhythm that people would have bossa nova beats and kind of practice their guitar licks and their bass lines too. So I started with those very early drum machines and grew up later to finally have one that I could actually program instead of being stuck with the samba and the bossa nova beat. I was really making records when the 808 started to happen, which was a god.
Well, man, in looking at the information regarding the 808, I see that it is still highly sought after. It, in fact, sells for more now than it did back in the day because of its sound. Apparently, it was thought of as a lesser than because it was more economically priced. But these days, people are desperately trying to find them. Did you know that?
Well, I have a funny story. I purchased my 808 for $300 or $400 when it first came out. And last year, I sold it over the years and used samples, 808 samples, and some purist people, I don't get into it, but some people say it's not the same as the actual machine. The machines have little quirks in them that kind of just, they sound a little bit more real. It's a synthetic sound, how could it be real? But you know what I'm saying, a sample could be very static. And I wound up purchasing mine on eBay for $1,600. So I bought it for $400, sold it for $700 or $800, and had to pay $1,400. to get the 808 back into my life.
So you know for a fact then, yes, those are sought after. Now, you mentioned okay. Switched on Bach, which I'm fascinated that you did. I had that album many hundreds of years ago.
Wendy Carlos had that. Did that. I didn't do that, but I used to listen to that because
I did too.
You know, we would sit there and, you know, and put a bong in front of my face and not breathe any oxygen until I passed out. But we would listen to Pink Floyd and Turned On music, trippy head music. You know, in those days it was called the end of the psychedelic culture. You know, in the mid to late 70s. You know, I'm talking about 74, 75, 76. I was very young. I left home at a very, 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 very early age. I was 14 years old when I left home. My mom had Alzheimer's disease. We didn't know what it was at the time, just except for that. She's crazy, get out. And managed to kind of survive in the streets. And as a gay man, I had, you know, 14 years old, how do you have a boyfriend? I mean, he was 18. And he worked at the Continental Bath. And I went down there and I saw Bette Midler and Barry Manilow when she was nobody. And she, you know, the classic famous, her playing at the Continental with the towel and with Barry Manilow as her piano player, you know. And so I was there for way back then with songs that were just coming out, like Soul Makossa and Rock the Boat when they were first. Stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, it's good that you remember the good things. Being out in New York at 14 years old had to be a tough experience, yet you managed to save some good memories of seeing Bette Midler.
But things were a little bit different then. Things were a lot looser. At 14, I used to go to clubs, or 16, you know, for instance, Continental Bath. In those days, nobody asked you for ID, nobody asked you for proof. You know, I smoked cigarettes at 15, 16. You could buy a pack of cigarettes, no one asked for your ID. They just either just assumed you were old enough. I was a tall, big guy. You know, so I always looked a lot older than my age, but, you know, they probably figured I'm probably old enough to do it, and if not, hey, it's just a kid who's smoking cigarettes, you know what I mean? So, nobody said anything, so clubs, work situations and things like that were a lot different. You know, I had a job at CBS Records in the mailroom, and I think I stole more records than I actually delivered up to the floors because I was fascinated by records and music, you know. They say this is a hot record and it's got to go up to the 23rd floor. And, it, you know, it's so-and-so's, you know, latest release. You know, it's a Billy Joel release or whoever it was at the time. And I'd say, okay, and I'd go in the hallway and put it in my bag to go home and listen to it and study it. You know,
so
and
was
of course
this
I dropped
the...
it off. I gave it to the receptionist, you know.
Right. So is this the job you had in your later teenage years that when you first bought the Radio Shack synthesizer and began experimenting?
Yeah. I mean, I hung out with, back then when I bought the little Radio Shack, dude, I'm 15, 16 years old and smoking pot and, you know, making synthesizer sounds, hanging out at clubs at night and, you know, I couldn't hold out a job. I was out of my mind. You know, 3 months at 16 years old was a long run in any particular job. Worked in clothing stores and worked at Sam Goody music stores up here in the East Coast of New York. I've worked at CBS Records and a couple of other places. I remember working in a men's clothing store, and every time the underwear or the Speedo representative came in, for some reason I was always the guy they asked to go in the back and put on the Speedos, and they'd come out and go, "Oh, look at that. That looks good. That looks good." So, for somebody, you know?
Yeah, it all becomes clear as we look back on it.
It sure does.
Man, someone of your talent.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that someone of your talent and potential must have gotten bored very quickly with the Radio Shack machine. So you moved quickly from that, I would guess.
Yeah, well, there wasn't a lot available on the market. My first was a Roland SH-101 synthesizer, and it was sort of like a glorified organ. I don't remember whether it was polyphonic or not. The old synthesizer modules weren't, but this may or may not have been. It had a couple of stops on the front, and you'd push these tabs down, and it would say flute or tuba, and it took a simple oscillator and it had a filter on it, and it was very basic. nothing controllable, really. You couldn't synchronize it with a drum machine or a tape machine. In those days, I had a 15-inch reel-to-reel tape machine and two giant Oltec Lansing Voice of the Theater speakers. And
wow.
My neighbor's nuts by, actually, my boyfriend at the time had it, but I'm sure we drove them nuts because, you know, there was probably a black light with a Dayglow poster, you know, glowing out the window and all these out-of-space sounds going on out of the house and the smell of pot. And, you know, they kind of avoided me in the hallway. You know, there's that freak living up there making all those weird sounds, you know.
So you were making this music and recording it to the 15-inch reel-to-reel and...
Sound.
Sound
on sound. So you would take the left channel, and it wasn't even four track then. You would take the left channel, bounce it to the right, and you take the right channel and bounce it back to the left, and you would build up layers and layers. And I called them soundscapes. So they weren't rhythmic because I didn't have a drum machine, but it would be ambient sound now, or not quite new age because it wasn't musical. They were just kind of layers of sounds and waves of sound. So I came from a very experimental background, and I stopped doing, you know, smoking pot when I was like 16, 17, but I actually wound up getting hooked up with a friend of mine. Her name is Cherry Vanilla. She worked with Andy Warhol and all these people going on downtown, and her manager was the guy who gave us pot. And he said, there's a party going on downtown. Why don't you come down and join the party? Everybody's going to be there. And we're like, well, okay, whatever. Walked in and... there was Andy Warhol and all these downtown, you know, celebrities that I did, Candy Darling and all these people that I didn't know who they were. You know, I was 16, 17, 18 years old, and the cast of Sgt. Pepper's that was on Broadway at the time. And, it was in a loft, and, you know, I'm sure I didn't drink the punch, but I'm sure it was spiked because that's what you did in those days. It was socially acceptable behavior. And, I got involved with this kind of underground group of New York City people, and this is the first time that people that were quote unquote artists weren't weirdos. They were considered, you know, respectable people. You're not a weirdo because you do music or strange sounds with your synthesizer. You're an artist, or you're experimenting with art. So I found a home amongst these people, you know, for many years in the underground New York City community. Like that. I was much younger than I should have been in that situation, but by today's standards. But back then, you know, it was commonplace. I had friends like Man Cloud. I don't know if you knew, they had that TV show on Channel 13, The All-American Family, back in the late 70s. He was one of the first reality TV shows, so to speak, on PBS. And he came out on national public television back in the 70s and had to leave his little town of wherever they were in Ohio or something and came to New York. So he was somebody else who was around my age that I became close friends with. But he knew Andy Warhol and all these fabulous people. So we would go to these little parties, and, you know, for me it was free food. I didn't have a job, you know, but I wound up getting into this group of people that I wasn't a freak. I wasn't some weirdo making music. I was an artist, and I was respected by other people. So that's how my musical stuff really kind of solidified and became more of a permanent thing in my life.
I see. Well, did you mention Klaus? I'm sorry, I dropped a word on this end.
Sure.
I'm wondering if this is about the period of time that you met. You were influenced by the what you call electronic experiments of a good friend, Klaus and Brian. Is this about the time you met them, began hearing other electronic artists?
Are you talking about Klaus Nomi, or which
yes,
about?
Yes, Klaus Nomi and Brian Eno.
Right. Brian Eno. We used to go to the Mud Club in New York, and Brian Eno, I think, was staying above there, and he used to come downstairs and hang out. And there was a lot of experimental music. I was very much into, you know, music for airports and the ambient kind of stuff. It was just so different from everything else. In those days, you were either rock and roll or disco. All of a sudden, there was this new kind, just non-melodic experimental music that was starting to emerge, you know. So I became, you know, kind of aware of this different kind of genre of stuff. And New York City had something called the New Wave Vaudeville Show, and I was working with Lance Loud, and that's just about the time when disco, they had that whole death to disco thing going on. So we thought, what can we do to be outrageous? We took the Sex Pistols Anarchy in the UK and did a Giorgio Moroder Donna Summer version of it, which was like could have started a riot in the right kind of club.
Yes, I should think so.
Yeah, we performed it on stage, and you know, it was tongue in cheek and camp. And I remember going back up to the dressing room and talking to some people, and we heard this opera music. That's like opera. This is new wave vaudeville. You know, what's this opera business? And they said, oh, you have to come. You have to see this. There's a guy in a clear plastic raincoat with some makeup on and a smoke machine and a strobe light, and he's literally singing. And I was like, what? And so I remember running downstairs and standing in the balcony looking out over the stage, and there was Klaus Nomi singing his operatic stuff. And I was like, that guy's really singing. Afterwards, he came back upstairs, and I said, I just want to tell you, I think that's really cool and great. He goes, yeah, I like your music too. You sound like Giorgio Moroder. I want to be like Donna Summer. Maybe we do some music? And I said, sure, you know. You know, this will be one for the record, you know what I mean? So
we became friends
and did some experimental music. I had a loft in Midtown Manhattan. We hung out with Keith Haring and Kenny Scharf and some of those artist types. And everybody hung out at my house, you know. There were no rules, no boundaries. People would just fall asleep on the floor, you know. Bunch of kids in a loft and that kind of stuff. But Klaus would come by and we'd do some music. And as he got more and more attention, he built his band. And then I kind of got involved with doing some tracks with him. And, you know, his management wanted him to be rock and roll because in those days electronic music was not commercially available. And if they wanted to make any money, they'd have to give him a band and take him on the road. So I became like a studio kind of place for him to experiment. So
I see. Well, we are in fact posting a link to some photographs of Klaus in the chat room, and it may very well be the picture that you're referring to. It looks like a sort of a cone type cylindrical raincoat. For those of you who are not in the chat,
there's a movie.
Yes, please.
Nomi song.
Go ahead.
Nomi song and. I think it's for rent in some of these places. I'm in the movie as well. And one of the bonus things on the DVD is a track, one of his old tracks that I finally, 10, 20 years after he died, got to actually remix and probably put it in more in line with what he wanted to do rather than what his rock and roll band and management forced him to do. So,
well, he's quite a character. Netflix, in fact, has that movie available if you're a Netflix subscriber. I didn't realize that you were involved with the movie and actually have sound, and even in the movie, till this afternoon. I certainly intend to see it. When was that movie released?
About 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. We filmed it almost 8 or 10 years ago, and it went through a lot of revisions and legal licensing problems and all that kind of stuff. And it was an American living in Berlin. And he finally got the movie put together. It was released about 3 or 4 years ago. If you do get the DVD, there's a there's an additional you know, like a bonus features section of it where I tell some hysterical stories of meeting Klaus at the infamous Piers in New York and after shows in those days with the straight band members and all of us freaks would go out to the invade a bathhouse after doing a show and scare everybody to their, you know, with makeup on and perfect hair running around in towels and stuff like that. So those wonderful little war stories are there.
Well, for those of you who would like to see the movie, the full title is The Nomi Song, and that's spelled N-O-M-I. And by the way, man, we are posting links to your sites in the chat room. For those of you who are not in the chat room, you can find out about Man Parish at www.manparish.com, and that's Parish with two R's, manparish.com.
One N and two R's in Parish, yeah.
Yeah, and you can find him over at MySpace, too, by going to myspace.com/official man made.
Somebody else has Man Parish. Some kid took Man Parish and has it at his site as an option.
Uh-huh.
So I guess that's a type of flattery, which is really nice, you know.
Yeah. Well, was Klaus one of the folks you went to Studio 54 with? Was he around during those days?
No. Klaus was a little bit, well, about the same time, a little bit earlier. Studio 54 opened up, and I was a complete club kid at that point in New York. Now I'm a big old bear-looking kind of guy, I guess, but back then I had purple hair and a skirt and, you know, and yellow shoes and, you know, probably a clown. Look like Ronald McDonald, probably, if you look at the picture now. But I was a trendy little club kid, and I used to go to Dance Interior New York, Hurrah's, and everybody said there's this club opening at called Studio 54, and it's supposed to be the tell-all of all New York City clubs. And a friend of mine, this girl in my neighborhood, was sleeping with the doorman. And she said, oh, I know that club. I can get in anytime I want. I'm sleeping with the doorman. I said, you're kidding me. She says, you want to go? I'll take you. We went every Friday and every Saturday for 3 years without fail. Towards the end, a little bit less, but we got in parties where famous people were standing outside and couldn't get in because she knew the doorman. And she wound up being, she was a costume designer, so she would make little matching outfits, and we would show up like the Bobbsey twins in little space outfits and little, you know, plastic pants, you know what I mean, and all kinds of crazy little things that would get us through the door each week. And it was quite an experience. A lot of people think that Studio 54 was a big space, but it was actually a small theater. And you'd stand there and you'd be dancing, and what, you'd have Mick Jagger, Bianca Jagger, and, you know, Sylvester Stallone and Halston, and, you know, on and on and on through the celebrity list, you know what I mean? And to me, I wasn't into that kind of stuff, so it was just a cool kind of place to hang out. Later on, I think it was in the second year, my roommate, whose name is Joey Arias, who was the lead in Cirque du Soleil's Zumanity, worked at a place called Fiorucci in New York. And they were having their 10th anniversary, and my record Hip Hop Bebop was coming out at the time. And they said, would you like to headline the show at Studio 54 for their 10th anniversary? I was like, oh my God, yeah, of course. Well, they had somebody else, an unknown girl, singing, and she had a song called Holiday, and her name was Madonna, and she was my opening act.
Oh, that's priceless. You've got to go back away.
Yeah, which I have the poster for.
Yeah.
And the day that, a week before we did that show, my mom had passed away, so I went from the grave to Studio 54 to do rehearsal. And I was completely like a vegetable at this point. And they said, do you have a special entrance? Do you want to do anything special? And I said, well, I would really love to come down from the ceiling. So sure enough, they rigged it up and they wired me up and we went to rehearsal once or twice. You know what I mean? And the night of the show, they put down a screen, lifted me up into the rafters of Studio 54. And I remember this little, I'm 6'3", this little guy, must have been 4 or 5 feet tall, said, I'm going to lift you up today. And I went, Jesus Christ, I mean, are you going to hold me? Are you going to drop me to the five story? You know, you're going up 3 or 4 or 5 stories there. And he said, sure, no problem, we counterweight you. He said, but just whatever you do, don't rock back and forth because there's 20,000 volts of neon signs on either side, and you'll electrocute yourself and probably put glass all over the floor. They're more worried about the floor downstairs than me being electrocuted and falling off this little bird perch that they put me on. But It was quite an experience. I wish there was a video from it. I think there's some photos floating around, which I don't have. But
speaking of videos, man, I did manage to locate a short video on YouTube, which I posted under your calendar date at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. I believe it's one of the ones in the purple hair time. just so people could see.
That was an art rock band, yeah.
And man, I'm beginning to understand. I'm beginning to understand better. You refer to an extended family, and that you converge nightly at Studio 54. And I understand how, I'm beginning to understand anyway, why you would use that phrase when you leave home that early, when you're 14. In fact, that really was your family.
Well, here's the difference. Today, in those days, the East Village, Greenwich Village in New York City, for those who didn't live in New York, There's one legend that I'm friends with now, many years later. Her name is Roll Arena. And she, like, for instance, she'd be walking down 7th Avenue, Christopher Street in New York, and someone would whiz by you in a fairy godmother outfit with cat's-eye glasses and a wand on roller skates going up into traffic on 7th Avenue and Broadway, and cars would be trying not to hit her, and she'd be blessing all the cars, and people would be laughing, and the cops would chase her, and she'd disappear down some alley and never be seen again, and she would famously appear. So in those days, people were individuals. Some were obviously crazy, but other people were just individuals, and you were considered not so much brave or cool, but everybody, you know, it was more accepted in a sense. So a lot of these people kind of converged in New York City because you couldn't walk around a small town in the Midwest with purple hair without probably getting killed. But in New York, either you were nuts and avoided, or you were respected for some way or another. So in that sense, it was an extended family. You can go into a club, you could go with a party at somebody's house, and you weren't that weirdo. You were like, okay, you're cool, you're accepted. What do you do? I'm interested in knowing what's your life about. And people were more open, more expressive. You know, there wasn't so much of the politically correct kind of stuff going on, you know, which took a lot of the fun out of that. I'm in New York City now, and I've been in the club scene since in the 70s or 80s, and it's drastically changed. I'm at the Cock Bar in New York on Sundays. I have a party called Sperm, which we could talk about. But today, somebody just put a little tiny piece of graffiti on the door, and the city sent him a letter immediately telling him that if he didn't remove the graffiti, it would be $several thousand in fines, or the city will come and remove the graffiti themselves. And the graffiti's maybe, you know, a little 2-foot piece of graffiti. So the politically correctness that's now didn't happen back then. So you had families and you had like-minded people, either sexually oriented or creatively oriented, that kind of were together. You know what I mean?
Well, man, would you say that it was the artist amongst your extended family that allowed you to believe in yourself enough to release something like
that? Absolutely.
Yes,
absolutely, because you weren't out on a limb. You know, as long as you weren't hurting yourself or hurting somebody else, people were supportive. And if I said I wanted to do an experimental music track and try to have some lights or lasers or something kind of cool, people go, yeah, that's great. You know, I know a way you can get government funding, you know what I mean? Or there's an artist grant that you could do because I did it. Let me help you. So you weren't, oh, what are you, crazy? You're going to do that? Why don't you get a job, a real job? You know, you didn't get that kind of feedback. You had permission to be yourself and to experiment. I mean, obviously, as long as you weren't hurting anybody or you weren't doing anything destructive. And it's ironic, but people were less destructive then than they were now because so many people are bottled up right now or can't express themselves because of all the politically correct kind of stuff. So they tend to party a little too much and do their drugs or their destructive behaviors, where back then, you know, people had outlets. You're frustrated, you can do a piece of art or you could write a song or you can be a performance artist or be an actor or some sort of way to get it out of your system. Now,
Manny, please tell us how you led up to what happened just before and how you came up with the idea of hip-hop bebop, which I understand was...
Hip-hop bebop was an experimental record with a beat underneath it. Because if you look at the structure of the song, there is no verse, chorus, and bridge. There are no lyrics. There is no real melody. I had an 8-track, half-inch tape recorder. Most of the records I did in that day, including the Man to Man record, the Male Stripper record, were done in my house on an 8-track, half-inch tape recorder. So the drums were on channel 1, the bass was on channel 2, the vocals would be on channel 3 with maybe a background on 4, leave me 4 more tracks for maybe percussion, a couple of keyboard parts, so on and so on. So Hip Hop Bebop started out as this experimental kind of track with a drum beat, with an 808 drum beat underneath it. And at the same time, I did a soundtrack for a Joe Gage a porno movie. And that came through, I was really, literally a starving artist. I was living in an art gallery, and they let me live there. If I swept the floors every day, I had a cot in the back, and I had a hot plate but there was cold running water. I had to boil water and put a sponge into my armpits and, you know, and take a shower that way. Or I'd go home with somebody and say, can I use your shower? kind of situation. So I was really the starving artist, and I wound up doing... I just lost my train of thought for a second. I'm sorry. But hip-hop people was an experimental thing in the loft that I lived in. And...
Ma'am, are you surprised? Were you surprised at the wide acceptance? I understand that hip hop bebop is now even being used in a. Is it in a PlayStation or?
It's in Grand Theft Auto 1 and 2. it's in Shaun of the Dead movie. They hold it up about a half hour and they say hip hop bebop greatest record in the world. I didn't ask them to do it. They just did it on their own. I actually had to go out and buy a PlayStation to actually know that it was in there because it was licensed through another company that claims they own it.
In your wildest dreams, man, did you ever think it would come to your music being in a video game?
No. And I was kind of, in those days, I was quote-unquote cutting edge. I had a computer, Radio Shack TRS-80 computer. You know,
that's cutting edge.
Yeah, I could do little squares that maybe the size of... You know, there would be big chunks and clunks on the screen right now, and I would try to do little simple animations. In those days, computers had 16K of memory, maybe 32K of memory, and you would load the program in through a cassette tape recorder. It would take 10 or 15 minutes to load a Pong program. And that relates to one of the music things that I did. I had Giorgio Moroder's MC8 Micro Composer, which in those days, you didn't play it into a computer. You typed all the numeric values of the music that you were doing into this hexadecimal keypad. Okay, so
if
the lowest key on the keyboard was 0, and the highest was 127. You'd have to figure out what a C was and a D was and an E and an F.
Oh my stars!
Wait, it gets better than that. You type in a note value, and then you type in a time value. So is it an 8th note, a 16th note, a dotted note? And every bar had to equal 24 of these things. So you'd put in a note value, a trigger value, and a gate value for each note. And I remember
all of it hexadecimal.
I had it plugged in, and I did about 9 hours of work. And my dog came running into my room, jumped up on my lap, pulled the plug out, and everything was gone.
Oh, man.
I had a war with synthesizer programming and stuff like that.
Hip-hop
was picked up from a record label, which a lot of DJs know as Disconet. It was a famous remix. A lot of the older DJs out there will remember that. My ex-boyfriend at the time was a editor for a magazine in New York called Mandate, or one of those magazines. And Joe Gage was doing, you know, gay adult films. Said, I need somebody to do music. And my friend said, oh, you got to go to Manny Parrish. She's got synthesizers and could do all this great sound. It'd be great for a soundtrack. So I didn't see the movie, but Joe said, I need a couple of songs here and there. And I could use a title song, about 8 minutes long, called Heatstroke. And I said, well, what's the scenario? It's a guy goes downtown, and supposedly he's straight, but winds up with another guy. I said, okay, let me see what I could do. We wind up doing it, he puts it in the movie, I score the rest of the movie just by giving me a 4-minute piece of music and a 2-minute piece of music. Didn't see the film until long after it came out. But there was a New York City DJ called Lance Weiss. He got the Betamax tape of it, made a recording and of the Heatstroke song, had it burnt to acetate, and played it at the famous Anvil Club in New York. Someone came up to me and said, do you know they're playing your song from that movie at the Anvil? And I said, can't be. I didn't sign it. Because you've got to go there. He's playing tonight. So I went down to the Anvil, and I'm standing around, and Felipe from the Village People, dressed as an Indian, was on the bar dancing, and you know, other New York City characters and stuff like that. And
yeah.
I went, oh, this place is cool. I kind of like it, you know, kind of a freak show right up my alley. And my song comes on. So I walk up to the DJ booth, and I said, hi, I remember very distinctly climbing up the little wooden stairs, looking over to the DJ booth and seeing the vinyl turning and the needle down and hearing my song, and my heart dropped. I thought, oh, somebody stole my music. This is terrible. And I said to him, I said, excuse me. I said, that's my music. He says, what? And I said, that's my music from the Heatstroke record. Somebody told me you were playing it. He goes, I got to get your number. There's a record company, and they're dying to find out who did this. song.
I'll be darned.
And the next day I went up there and signed my life away on a half-page, one-paragraph thing of the 22-year-old kid. And the guy said, do you have any other music? And I said, well, I have some experimental music. I have a song called Man Made and this hip-hop bebop. I just spit out the words, hip-hop bebop, because I know hip-hop in those days wasn't used. It was rap music. But hip-hop is a jazz term for dancing. Hip-hop bebop, dance to the jazz music, don't stop. So I said, I have this song called, and my brain just said, hip-hop bebop, don't stop. And he said, I'd like to hear it. So we wound up developing it a little bit more. We put some dog barks on it, and I basically ran the tape from beginning to end. There was no structure, and it was all put together in the mix. We did about 30 different mixes, and in those days it was splicing with a razor. We sat there and spliced the song together, and we tried to make some sense out of it over a weekend. And I remember when they put it out, I was embarrassed. I said, this isn't a song. There's no chorus, there's no verse, there's no structure. I want to be a pop star. I didn't want to be a musical, unknown. I said, nothing's ever going to happen with this. I had a huge fight. Well, the record started taking on its own life because it just sounded very unique. The dog barks in there were a reference to a club in New York City called the Fun House. And at the Fun House, there was a DJ called John Jellybean Benitez. And there was a girl that used to hang around with him with long black hair before the Studio 54 thing. And her name was Madonna. And she kind of, she's a nobody, but she had a T-shirt that said, I'm Madonna.
And, yes, yes.
We used to bring records to him, and he would play them. And if the crowd liked the music, they would bark. If they didn't like the music, they would boo. Unlike today when they just stand there with their arms crossed staring at you.
Yes, 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 with that terrible frown on their faces.
Yeah, very good feedback. So we thought we would put dog barking in the record, kind of referencing back to them what they were giving to the DJ. It was kind of a reversal, and no one had done that before. So, of course, those kids love the record because, oh, it's that record, the dog barking, and we dog bark, woo, 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 which Arsenio Hall later picked up and did. So
that's where he got it.
On those grounds. And at that time, Disconet put out all these DJ mixes, and I started to do my album. It was at a studio in New York called Vanguard Studios, which is part of Vanguard Records, a jazz label. But everybody used the studio. When other studios were $100, $150 an hour, this was $25 an hour. The record label had this huge studio space, and jazz was on its decline then. And they would rent it to anybody just to pay the rent. So when I would go to the studio, before me would be Arthur Baker and John Rovey doing Planet Rock. And after, when I was ending, I had to get out because the kids who did Freeze, A-E-I-O-U, were behind them. And, we'd walk in and Shannon would be singing Gimme Tonight. And I worked indirectly on the Alicia records back then, those old club records. Because I had samplers, I had synthesizers and drum machines that most of these people didn't have. Arthur Baker had a drum machine, synthesizers I did. And one or two other people, John Rovey, had synthesizers and samplers. So we would they'd either ask to rent our equipment or borrow our equipment. And again, it was extended family. You just lent your $2,000 synthesizer to somebody and go pick it up 2 days later, because that's what people did for each other. So, we wound up directly or indirectly playing on a whole bunch of records back then. It was like a little New York Motown.
I see. Well, I would like for the listeners to be able to hear a couple of your earlier tracks, if we can get to Hip Hop Bebop and also Heatstroke. And I also certainly don't want to miss some of the newer stuff. I understand there's another wave of electro fans coming along, and that you're enjoying a new popularity.
The electro stuff picked up really big in the UK, and when that happened, a lot of people started asking questions, where's electro from? And of course, Kraftwerk became a big thing over in Europe. And I was one of the first people, not to put out a synthesized record, but to put out a full album that was American-based, that wasn't, Europe-based, because there was there were groups in New York like Suicide and these esoteric kind of groups, but their music was not as structured for an American palate, so to speak. I had Heatstroke going on in the gay clubs. I had hip-hop bebop in the hip-hop clubs, and I had a song called Man Made in the New Wave Club. So I was oblivious to all this. The record company kept all this from behind me. I wound up at that time, 2.5 million records to date, 3.5 million records, and I never got paid on a penny for any of that stuff that I did because it was that classic story, sign here, kid, and the guy bought a plane you know, and a Porsche and a beautiful house and, you know, did all this, these wonderful things and just said, you know, keep singing, kid, you'll make me a lot of money. So,
well, man, have you to this day been paid for any of those huge hits?
I'm in a lawsuit actually right now with Unidisc Records out of Canada because I.
So Canadians have bought the rights to it. Is that the idea?
In those days, the owner of the record label, just from partying so hard, was one of the first people to come down with, like Klaus Nomi, with HIV. But in those days, it wasn't called HIV. It was called GRID, which is gay-related immune deficiency. And they gave you penicillin, and when you visit people in the hospital, you wore a gown and a mask because they didn't know if it was airborne. It was very, very early stages. And he used to take my records and put little bags of Coke and send it out to the radio stations. And I found all this stuff later, like years later, but he put little party drugs in there and $100 bills and, you know, paying
all
the DJs and the Billboard reporters and stuff to play my record. But in those days, New York City radio was KTU. There wasn't a lot of dance radio, and I didn't have the kind of money where I could go to big clubs. I went to the States a couple of times. I went to these other clubs that I got in for free, but some of the discos weren't really established that much then, and a lot of the clubs I couldn't afford to go in. So I was unaware, other than occasionally picking up a Billboard magazine and seeing myself on the dance charts, how the records were doing. So all that was kept from me. You know what I mean? Later on, kids went back to their history and wanted to know what's the history of a drum machine. We know synthesizers and electronic bands like Erasure were happening in the 80s and stuff like that. So a lot of kids kind of got real turned on to my sound. You know, I get all this, you're the godfather of music and you're a legend and this is a polite way of saying you're an old man at this point.
Well, your music is still considered to be absolutely classic and definitive versions. So the story they were giving you is that production costs are so high that there's not enough return for us to...
No. What I get was the story was it takes several months. We put out a record, and it takes 6 months to get paid from a distributor. It's usually 90 days. And then after that 6 months, we have to pay... through some production costs. I didn't get an advance. I didn't get anything out of that.
Oh, man. I'm
probably,
sorry.
You know, the whole recording cost, most of it was done in my house. So we just did some sweetening and mixed it down. If they spent $3,000 putting that album together, maybe. And then he said, well, and after that, you know, we have to do our accounting, and it takes 6 months to maybe a year when you get paid. But that's normal. Don't worry about it, kid. Go out and do a couple of shows. You can make maybe $1,000 doing a show. And I'd do a show, and I'd have dry ice machines and balloons and pyrotechnics, and I'd spend like $900 on the show and walk away with $100. So people's mouths were hanging open, you know, and glitter and makeup, and we would get go down to Soho and get Kanta Yamamoto and some of these really cool designers. We'd walk in and say, we have a record, we want to feature your stuff on stage, it's unique, and they would lend us clothes, and we would put on these spectacles in these new wave clubs and in these hip-hop clubs and rock and roll clubs where, in those days, you know, it was called rap. It wasn't called hip-hop. So you'd have guys in Adidas track suits and Kangol hats and sneakers. And we came out in skirts and graffiti jackets and, you know, glitter spraying all over the place and 3-foot balloons. We'd love to blow up these giant balloons and fill them with glitter. And some jerk in the audience would always be mean and try to pop it with their cigarette, and at the end of the night, you'd see one person leaving that was completely doused in glitter, and you knew they were the person that broke the balloon, you know what I mean, because they were being mean. But quite a spectacle, you know, when we look back on it. It was
well, man, was if hip-hop bebop was very popular in the hip-hop clubs, and the heat stroke was running along in the gay clubs, you said there was a third track also that was popular at the same time?
It was a so-called man piece, and they played that in the new wave clubs. It was Kraftwerk-ish. You see,
you had three records running at the same time, and radically different.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that until all this came by way later. One of the people who worked for the record company wound up working for me for one of my parties, and he goes, "You don't know me, but I used to work for the record company. I was one of the the guy started out as a single person and wound up, you know, hiring like 12 or 14 people. And he said, I used to work for the record company, and, you know, you're quite a legend. I said, what are you talking about? I didn't sell that many records. He goes, are you kidding me? I said, they never paid me. I just figured I never made any money. He goes, let me sit down and tell you what's going on. He said, you know, this is in the 90s. He said, you sold 2.5 million records, and, you know, you funded, you know, his lavish lifestyle in our office for years and years to come. And after the guy died, his second right-hand man put a key in the door and kept the business running. The guy had a coke problem and sold off catalog for $1,000 here and there to go buy coke and party all weekend. And
oh, my stars.
Went out the door with everybody else's. And those days...
Well, man, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Well, it'll be resolved now. I mean, you know, things... you know, I believe in, you know, the good of the universe and all that kind of hokey stuff, so things will...
but
in those days, Canada was a separate country, so you could take stuff, go to Canada, mass-produce it, steal it, and then bring it back in as imports. It wasn't like today, where it's terrorism, where they look through every box to see if there's a bomb and stuff. You could ship, manufacture it out in Canada and bring it back into America, and no one, you know, it was an import record, and no one questioned it. And sometimes even the record labels didn't know whether they licensed it out to other countries. And some countries in Mexico and Canada, they would go get the latest, whoever was, you know, the latest Boy George record and mass duplicate it and bring it back into the country, and no one would go after them. Well, when NAFTA came around,
Lord have mercy,
the trade agreement, all of a sudden there was no border between Canada and America. So if you bought a contract in the U.S., you also bought all the baggage with it, and you bought all the responsibility. So this particular company couldn't hide behind the border anymore. And, I didn't know that we would sold records, and I figured there were a couple of licenses here and there, but I was probably one of those one-hit disco wonders that, you know, sold 10,000 copies, and it probably cost me $50,000. I got advice from somebody, and they said it cost you $50,000 just to find out that they have a double set of books, and you'll make $10,000 back. Until it headed to Sony PlayStation, until it went into the movies, and I did some searching on the internet, and there were 70, 80 licenses out of there at $5,000 and $10,000 a piece.
Wow.
Including the royalties, and the movie licenses are $40,000, $50,000, and the video game licenses, they sold 44 million copies of Grand Theft Auto. You know? And I didn't receive a penny. So things have changed over the years from being screwed. I left high school very early. I went to high school performing arts where the movie Fame was, and it was very much like the movie. I worked at the Metropolitan Opera House as a spear carrier and an extra on stage for $10 a scene, and I did that for a couple of years to make some money. But yeah, I have quite a great book that's going to, one of these days.
I bet. Well, man, I'd love for the listeners, many of the listeners, we have a diverse audience, and we have many straight listeners who are progressive, of course, but who listen to the show, and we have the LGBT folks.
Hey,
exactly, and we have the whole DJ crowd, whatever they are, and we've got So I'd like to share with them. Many have heard it, but I'd like to share with them the hip hop bebop. Glenn did an edit
did you
for
say
us.
Share or scare?
I would like to share, absolutely share.
This, my friends,
is the track that is being used in Grand Theft Auto. Isn't that a Microsoft product, man?
No.
Or is it one of the others?
It's built by it, and then there's a company called Rockstar Game, and they're now rivaling Hollywood in some of their incomes on some of these products.
Amazing. Well, Bob, if you would roll the hip-hop bebop track, and I'd like the folks to hear one of his very early, and this was a major crossover hit.
This was 1983, by the way. This was before computers and before MIDI. We would have to stop the tape recorder every so many bars, and I'd have to hand punch in drum beats. And like two flashing lights, I would start the drum machine and run for 8 bars. It would run out of sync with the rest of the track. We'd rewind it 4 bars and then punch it back in and go another 12 bars, and it would run out of sync. And we'd do this for the length of a
labor of love.
When we got in line, it was really, it wasn't push-button synthesizer with a computer like people have GarageBand and those sort of things today. This was truly a labor of love.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a moment to share that with the listeners. Bob, if you'd run the hip-hop bebop track. Thanks, Bob.
All
Don't stop.